Welcome to Inside Analog Photo. I'm your host, Scott Shepard. The Inside Analog Photo radio program is all about the traditional photographic process. We talk about all aspects of analog photography, including the hybrid workflow. You can find out more information over at www.insideanalogphoto.com. And of course, Inside Analog Photo is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful. These guys have the coolest instant photography materials known to mankind. They have, of course, the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4x5, color and black and white. They have the Instax systems in the wide format, the Instax 210 camera and film, and of course the Instax Mini, both in color film. Beautiful stuff. There's nothing cooler than instant photography. You get a print, because if you don't have a print, you don't have a real photograph. This is great fun stuff. This is great for art. This is great for business. This is cool stuff. You definitely want to check them out over at www.FujifilmUSA.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends over at DR5, DR5 Chrome Black and White Developing, that turns your black and white neg into, that's right, black and white chrome. Unbelievable stuff. www.DR5.com. Our official media partner, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, for all things traditional photographic process on the web, www.apug.org, and our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.eastmanhouse.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to be here with the fabulous Ron Mowry. Ron's going to join us today to talk about the current situation with Eastman Kodak. You know, Ron was there for many, many decades. And today we're going to speak with Ron about what Kodak did wrong, from Xerox to digital. So Ron's going to join us today. We're going to look at all kinds of different little situations and scenarios, what Eastman Kodak might have done differently to change the face of what's going on today. Of course, Ron's got his brand new book out, the DVD set. He's teaching with Mark Osterman at the Eastman House, and there's a lot of cool stuff going on. Ron spends a lot of time and gives great information over at APUG.org at APUG, and he's a value to the photographic community. So sit back and relax while we chat with Ron Mowry. Ron, how you doing today?
Just fine. Scott, how you doing?
Good, pal. Thanks for joining us here again on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program today to talk about a very interesting topic that I think a lot of people have been pontificating about. And we're going to talk today about what happened with Kodak, where Kodak went wrong. So again, thanks, buddy, for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome, Scott. I'm happy to be here. As George Burns said, at 100 years old, I'm happy to be anywhere. So I'm going to be talking from an ant's view, looking way up the chain at Kodak, because I'll be starting this tale in about 1972, and I'll be jumping around in time to give you an idea of what I saw happening from my level at Kodak. And this has become pertinent because, of course, while we're recording this, Kodak is struggling in the throes of bankruptcy. And we're all worried about where our pensions and our benefits are going to go here in Rochester.
Well, yeah, it's pensions and benefits and health care, and really even the whole world that consumes analog materials are wondering. And we're not trying to be disrespectful to Kodak or anything they've done, but we just are trying to look at this thing and try to figure out, okay, well, what's going to happen?
Yes, I'm trying to take that approach, and I'll be doing that today. I'll start out by saying that after C41 and Ektaprint 3 were introduced in the early 70s, Kodak was sued by Berkey and GAF and a few other companies because they had introduced competing products for the old processes, which were now obsolete. And I'll get back to this in a minute. But what I'd like to do is say that I was part of a litigation team that went around and collected data for this lawsuit. I was also deposed for it because I was part of the development team on Ektaprint 3. And one of the tasks that Kodak assigned me to was to look at previous lawsuits and the results and everything like that, and also previous approaches from other companies. One of the things that I read was the 5-star Blue Ribbon Committee that interviewed Chester Carlson when he came to Kodak with his Xerox machine. This was between, I believe, 1939 and 1944. Anyhow, Chester Carlson went to some 20 companies and was turned down. Kodak turned him down, too. This was one of the biggest mistakes that Kodak ever made. And reading the report was absolutely fascinating because they compared xerography, a clumsy, clunky, room-sized machine that's noisy, filled with faults and everything. They compared it to Verifax. And secondarily, I suppose they probably could have compared it to Mimeograph. But they compared it to Verifax, and if anyone remembers that, it was a light-sensitive material that you put in contact with your original. We exposed it to bright light, dipped the light-sensitive material into an activator, and then laminated it and let it sit for a minute. Then you peeled it apart. And if you were lucky, you could do it two or three times and get two or three copies. And they thought this was just the best thing for copying since sliced bread was invented. They thought this was great, and Xerox would never go anywhere. Now, this was in the 40s, and I would have said, well, look, gentlemen, compare this to the first automobile or the first airplane. He didn't have a product, and he didn't get a product out the door until about 1957 or something like that, because I remember they started to come out just as I went into the Air Force. And he was doing it with a company here in Rochester, Haloid, which became Haloid Xerox and then became Xerox. And the first Xerox machine, sure, they had problems. But that would have been a big boon for Kodak. And that taught me that Kodak was very self-centered on analog photography. They couldn't think outside the box. Now, to get back to the lawsuit in the early 70s, Berkey, GAF, and the other companies said, look, we've got processes that were compatible with Kodak's processes, and now they've changed them. They did it arbitrarily to hurt us. Well, I saw the research. Nobody there gave a darn about hurting anybody. In fact, GAF's new color paper went through our new Ektaprint 3 process as good or better than our own new paper. And our own new paper was designed the way it was because we had to get rid of cadmium. Now, when I was working on the lawsuit, I said, look, their paper goes through our process as good or better than ours, and yet they're suing us to go back to the old process or that we did it to hurt them. Why don't we just tell them that? Oh, no, we can't tell them that. We can't give them that information. That would help them, even though it would destroy the lawsuit. And I'm thinking to myself, they'd rather win the battle than the war. They completely missed the point at Kodak that we've got perfect evidence that GAF's color paper went through our new process as good as ours. All you had to do was change development time. They used 6 minutes in the old, we used six. In the new, we used 3.5, theirs went through in 3.5. But if you use six, it fogged. You had to use a shorter development time. To go on, at that time, we were developing CD6 to replace CD3 in Ektaprint 3 processing. This allowed us to reduce the silver content of the paper, but get the same dye curves, and get a modest improvement in dye stability. It varied with the tests we had, but we were working on it. They said the CD6 development program is canceled completely. Why? Well, we don't want to make another change in the process and face another set of lawsuits. So a whole project was canceled at Kodak simply to avoid a second set of lawsuits because they were afraid they were going to lose the first one, but they had the evidence in hand to prove that at least part of the first one was spurious. And I just sat back, my jaw dropped. I couldn't believe the logic behind this. But basically, it was born out of fear. They were afraid to rattle anybody because we were the big giant. And the courts and everybody took a dim view of Kodak. And so Kodak not only was insular, afraid to think out of the box, but they were frightened or low in, let's say, courage when it came to facing the public. They had been frightened by the consent decree, by people's viewpoint that they were a big monopoly, and this set the stage for later developments, Scott. It really did.
Do you think this had trickled down year after year, decade after decade, after these original things happened, that Kodak became completely gun-shy?
I am honestly not sure. I don't know. But I suspect that it caused at least confusion in the ranks. They didn't know which way to jump, and that may have mixed the messages that went about internally. I wasn't high enough at that time to see any of those. But anyhow, in the early to mid-80s, Kodak bought Verbatim and another company called DriveTech. DriveTech made high-density 3 to 10 meg floppy disks, believe it or not. And it was Kodak's idea that, oh, gee, we're coming along with digital scanning. We're going to have a lot of pictures, so we need a lot of storage. We're going to put them on floppies. They also built a high-capacity hard disk drive with many, many, many platters. And these were removable so that you could have many platter sets for different databases of photographs. So they were moving forward with this idea of scanning negatives, putting them on different types of disks. And they bought DriveTech and Verbatim to supply the low-end floppy-type storage. Well, as it turned out, the DriveTech drives took a separate card and BIOS to control them. This played havoc with most PCs because it was incompatible with most software, and many, many computers crashed. The other problem, and this is really, really strange, Kodak said that they had all the technology to build the drives and the heads, and building a head like this required the construction or the embedding of the iron magnet head into ceramic. Kodak said, we have the technology. It turns out that they didn't. They could make it, but it wasn't bubble-free. Now, let's imagine bubbles in ceramic with an iron recording and playback head embedded in there with it. This head was clamped onto the floppy, and of course, it acted like an abrasive, because what is a floppy disk made of but iron oxide, which is used as an abrasive in the jewelry industry as a polishing agent? Well, it very gradually wore away the ceramic, and that would be no problem if it wore it away with no bubbles in it. But if it did wear it away and there's a bubble there, the bubble turns into an ice cream scoop. And I was one of the beta testers for this equipment because I was using the big emulsion databases, big at that time. And I kept losing data, and one day I took the Kodak floppy out of my 5 or 10 meg disk, I forget which, and held it up to the light and you could look right through it. Because it was right where the directory was, it wore a hole through the disk. Well, now, at that time, Kodak had decided to build a lot of this in Rochester, and Gerber had just closed down their baby food plant here. So we had what we called the Gerber plant, which was the DriveTech and Verbatim setup and testing unit. So I drove down Mount Reed Boulevard to the Gerber plant, which was just south of the 3M plant on Mount Reed. And I went in and I told these guys about it, and they were dumbfounded. And I stood up in front of the meeting and I held up the disc to the light and showed them how you could look right through it. Right after that, I understand we sold Verbatim and we sold DriveTech, or DriveTech just vanished. The interesting thing is, just before you called, I found three packages of Verbatim Data Life discs for use with Kodak 3.3 megabyte disc drives or equivalent. And I've got them here. They were so slow in access time, so slow in rotation rate, head move. They had two head motors, a main head motor and a vernier that would tune in. It was so clunky, and Kodak spent millions on it. And they showed me at that time that they didn't understand the computer industry. Because you see, a few years before, 8-inch floppies, when they went from single-sided to double-sided, had a problem of wearing the disks out by the clamping of the head onto the floppy. And none of these engineers knew of that problem. And here I was just a peon, essentially, in the computer area. But I knew about it because all of this was published in PC Magazine, PC Week. It was all over the trade. So that's a second thing. Kodak jumped into things without knowing the industry. And as a corollary to that, the prices were plummeting on electronic equipment. And yet Kodak was planning on selling hardware, software, and consumables like CDs and DVDs at a given price, which would, at the time the plant came online, be as much as 10 times higher what the industry pundits predicted those items would be worth. So they built products that could not be sold at a profit, because they under-designed the plant, misestimated the prices, and they just failed. They didn't understand the industry.
Almost sounds like the current inkjet products.
Yes. Well, I'll get to them. I'm going to tell you, Kodak decided after the invention of the digital camera, and I've seen and held the original camera. It was about the size of half of a pack of cigarettes, with a great big lens on the front that somebody ripped off of a 16 millimeter camera, because the sensor was about 16 millimeter in size. The sensor was on a standard EEPROM sub with all the little pins. I think it was a 24 or so pin DIP package with a little window in it that went behind the lens, and it was connected to a box that you downloaded the picture to. So it was a really neat little setup. I've seen the chips and I've seen the system. And what they formed at Kodak was a technology forecasting committee that was supposed to say, what is digital going to look like over the next 50 years? And the forecasting committee came back and said, digital will not become important until the year 2020. Now, I was assigned by my division director to review their forecasting and give him a report. So I walked into his office with their report, and I said, they're wrong. And he looked at me and he said, these are some of the best scientists in the company. How can you dare say they're wrong? And I said, they're wrong. Digital is going to become significantly important before 2020. And he said, well, when? I said, I don't know. All I know is that a bunch of chemists can't predict what electronics people are going to do. And he said, oh, come on. These are great engineers and scientists. And I said, look, could Intel predict that we're going to come out with a 1,000-speed color film next month? And he said, no, how could they? They're a bunch of electrical engineers. And I said, bingo. And he said, it isn't the same thing. And I said, yes, it is. It's a two-way street. An electrical engineer, not knowing the internal workings of Kodak, can't predict what we're going to do with any degree of accuracy. No more so can we predict what they're going to do. They have things on the shelf, and we have things on the shelf. And I said, what's worse is that in reading the publications like PC Week and PC Magazine, you can see how the prices are dropping, and you can see how the capacity of sensor chips and memory chips are increasing. And by that token, if you draw that line out, it does not say this is going to become important in 2020. It says it's going to become important sometime between 1990 and 2010. That's all I can say. I can't get any closer because I'm no more of an electrical engineer than any of these people were. And he asked me to leave his office. He said, you're wrong. I saw him recently, and I said, well, and he said, okay, are you going to say I told you so? And I said, yep, I told you so.
And what year was this?
This was about 88. When was the digital camera invented?
77, 78?
Yeah, I saw it in about 82. They were still tinkering with some of the original models. I saw it in about 82.
So here's a question for you then, Ron. So Kodak started making professional digital cameras, and I'm assuming they were making the sensors as well. So how could Kodak come out with high-end digital cameras? Remember the DCS series of cameras and backs? These were $10,000 plus a piece or more. How could they come out with that and still market film? How do you have one hand saying digital is great, look at this, and the other hand going film is great, look at me, but nobody telling each other that one was better than the other? So you have this convoluted marketing nightmare of the film guys can't say that digital sucks because it's their buddy across the hall. And their buddy across the hall can't say, well, film sucks because this is Kodak.
Here's my sales pitch that just popped into my mind now. You can have a gas-driven car, you can have an electric car, or you can have a hybrid car. Take your pick. They've all got advantages and disadvantages. Right now, the electric car is in its infancy, though. So you have these drawbacks. You see what I'm saying? You don't have to play down or play up either one of them. You play them co-equal for their benefits, and all the people can stay happy and friends. That's the way I would play it. Everybody's co-equal. But Kodak made their own chip. In fact, up until they sold that unit recently, they made the best chips that went into more cameras than most people realized. In fact, their latest chip that they just came out with really blows everything away. And I believe they have it up to almost a medium format size. It's bigger than 35 millimeter, but I've lost track of it, and I don't remember what size they were going to make it in. But they were going to put it into medium format cameras.
I think the biggest sensor that you can currently get today is 645. That's as big as you can buy over the counter.
And that very well might be based on Kodak technology.
I'm sure it is.
May even be made by them. Or might have been made by them in the past. Well, after that, in the 90s, Kodak came up with this idea of a camera that was connected to the internet wirelessly. Where did Kodak go wrong? Their hardware and software implementation were clunky and slow, but it was the idea of the current phone. In fact, it was developed under the leadership of Fisher, who came from Motorola. So Kodak had the germ of an idea, but didn't carry it off right. Their second piece of work was the Easy Share, where people could share photographs on the internet. Again, Easy Share was pretty much of a failure. Facebook just overwhelmed it. And I guess it's a matter of quality, and there you have it. And then finally, they misestimated printing. They said people are going to want digital prints. No, they don't. They want to share them over the internet. They don't need print. They should have prints, in my personal opinion, but they're satisfied with shipping a digital copy to grandma or over the internet. Okay, so Kodak comes out with a whole line of personal printers when people don't want personal printers. They aren't making color prints at home. It's too much trouble. In addition, even though their inks are incredibly inexpensive compared to some other inks, they come in a brick. And as everybody knows, the colored inks don't run out all at the same time. So you're almost always wasting an ink brick when you run out of ink and have to buy a new one because you don't have any yellow or magenta left. My printer has ink cartridges. When one goes bad, I can go into a store and buy one ink cartridge for about half the price of a Kodak full ink cartridge. Yeah, it's more expensive on a single ink basis, but it pays out in time because I don't have to buy a whole set of 8 ink cartridges. So they've made a number of mistakes, and by the way, these are all online in either the Wall Street Journal or New York Times or all of these different analyses of Kodak. Where did Kodak go wrong? And I'm not picking anything out and saying, I knew this and it was a secret. Everything I've said is public knowledge. I've just put a little bit of a slant on it because, well, for example, with the Drive Tech stuff, I was one of the beta testers. That's not a secret. Or Kodak's interaction with Verbatim. Not a secret. I was just there and tested the stuff. So there's a short thumbnail sketch of where Kodak went wrong from a guy standing at the bottom of the well looking up.
And what we've talked about, these aren't small things. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. Look at this whole printing thing. I mean, Kodak is very successful in the dry toner commercial printing realm. They make these next-gen presses, and you have firsthand experience. So why don't you give us your outlook and what you've seen with Kodak dry toner professional presses? This is not little hoopty inkjets that you can buy for $100 at Target. They're big.
Okay, well, my book is about to be released. And it went to the printer last week, and he took me through his entire shop, and they use the smaller Kodak printers made in Heidelberg, Germany. They're Kodak printers. They use the same Kodak toner we're talking about, and he has Kodak toner stocked floor to ceiling. And he's got a double row of these Kodak printers that are almost man-high, like 4.5, 5 feet tall. More than that, if you include the little console sticking up in the back, and about 10 different drawers. And at the back pop books with 3 or 4 different kinds of binding at about 1 minute per book. Bang, bang, bang. I was standing there when the guy walked up, pressed the button, and then he walked to the end of the machine and had quit the previous job. And he said, by the way, this is yours. And he picks a copy of my book up and he hands it to me. And I said, what? And it took like 2 minutes to print it. Bind it, everything.
Done. Out the door. He hands you a finished product.
Now, I'm talking to the guy that owns the place. He is a former Xerox employee, but he has a shop full of Kodak printers. And I said, why? He said, they're superb. And he uses Kodak consumables. Now, I can't see why Kodak has to be bankrupt if it's still selling consumables like toner, color toner to boot, and they could make a living on analog photography selling color developer or Kodachrome developers. Why can't they make a decent profit on printer toners? Well, there's something wrong. Our daughter works at Xerox, and she's an engineer there. She doesn't talk much about the work. She's not allowed to. There are some changes going on in her division, but what I can say is that basically some of it involves these big walk-in print-on-demand machines. And I have been at demonstrations of them as a representative of the local school district. The Xerox machines and the Kodak machines are in direct competition, and Xerox appears to be making a profit, but Kodak isn't. Why?
Well, here's one that probably makes people happy. The home base of Xerox in Rochester, it's Xerox Fuji. What happened there? So it's interesting, why would Fuji be all on board with what Xerox is doing when Kodak initially kicked it to the street? And now Kodak is basing their future on this dry toner printing technology, okay? It's a dry process.
All right, let me give you an example of something really strange. Kodak copiers got awards for being the best in the industry back when they were first introduced. They were easier to fix, they had fewer jams, they printed more clearly. In fact, they ran a lot of tests to make sure that they printed Japanese characters, because there's a lot of problem with printing kanji, because some of the close brush strokes and everything. So, anyhow, Kodak built this beautiful copier. But then somebody at Kodak got the bright idea, let's outsource it and let Canon build the engine, and we'll just assemble it. So there were the copiers with the Kodak logo on them, but they had a Canon engine. Canon took the Kodak technology and redesigned it to work even more efficiently and came out with Canon copiers in direct competition to Kodak, and they clobbered Kodak. And a year later, I walked into the copy room in the research labs, and there was a Canon printer sitting there. Now, let me go back to the print shop where I got my book printed. I told you they were Kodak copiers, assembled by Kodak in Heidelberg. All of the boxes of toner had Kodak labels on it. The label on the copier was Canon and Kodak, and they still have Canon designed and built engines. So you might well say it's Canon Kodak. They're beautiful copiers, but they do have Canon labels and Kodak labels on them. The Kodak label, come to think of it, isn't all that prominent. When you first look at it, you see the Canon label. So there you are.
So, Ron, what's your thoughts on what Kodak has done? And let's just pick the past 5 years or 10 years, wherever you want to go, when it comes to the marketing of film. Do you believe that it would be wise to advertise and market film, or is it just a dead horse? And they don't spend any money on marketing because they know themselves that it's a dead horse? Or do you think they still believe that we are the almighty golden god and people will just flock to us because, well, when you think of Kodak, you think of film. What do you think?
There is such a mixed bag of attitudes at Kodak right now. I could say all of the above, really. Everything you've mentioned. Some people think Kodak can't do any wrong. Other people have made whole series of wrong decisions, thinking they're right, or knowing they're wrong. Who knows? I think that there is a future for film. I think Ilford is doing well. I know that people are building small-scale film and paper production plants to take up what Kodak is losing by their ineptitude. I think Kodak got so centered in on colored digital printers because of Mr. Perez's background, that they completely missed the boat on what they should really be doing in digital and what they should be doing in analog. If I were to say what I'd do, I would take a small but real portion of my income as a company and invest it in increased advertising of analog to professionals and amateurs. I would make analog photography a little more easily obtained at local stores. I would try to ensure people knew that analog was not dead. I would put somebody on APUG and PhotoNet, just like Simon Galley from Ilford, who tried to help people through problems, if they existed, or complaints. And I would try to divide that between analog and digital products in an equitable way. I would try to come up with a better digital strategy than printers, printers, printers on every amateur's computer desktop, because that doesn't seem to be the way the public wants to go. Maybe there is a printer out there that might satisfy this, but Kodak has to think outside the box to design it. It isn't here yet. But a standard USB port serial or wireless printer sitting on your desktop isn't what the consumer wants. Maybe they want to take a picture and press a button and it's sent to everybody, and then it can download them automatically to their printer or download wherever you're at to the printer wirelessly. I just don't know.
I think they missed the boat. like you said, the whole thing with Easy Share and the original technologies to be able to share these things, I just think it's gone. The boat pulled out of the harbor, and it's long gone. It's over the horizon.
Yeah, if they come up with a Facebook today, what are they going to do? They're going to compete with Facebook. That's why Facebook worked. The fellow thought outside of the box. Now, just to come up with another point to emphasize something here. Back in the 90s, Kodak was not a hardware and software company, particularly not a software company, no matter what they thought internally. Because a very good friend of mine worked in the hotline for the software for the early printers and early cameras and things that came out from Kodak. And his comment was, number one, they had too few people to handle the hardware and software problem calls that came in. Secondly, the software that went out with the product was buggy in many cases. And in one case, it actually wiped out the DOS config.sys and autoexec bat, stranding the person high and dry with nothing operational on their computer the way they wanted it to work. So the group was so overworked in one case, the whole group got up in arms and tried to complain about it, and finally most of them ended up quitting. I think they did it within a span of a few weeks and left Kodak with essentially no support group. And the reason I got it was because the guy I used to work in the emulsion area of research moved over to the support group. He took a bunch of courses in computers and moved to support. And when the support group started falling apart, he wanted to move back to emulsion. So I got the story from him when he interviewed with us for a new job. So Kodak has made so many internal mistakes jumping from pillar to post and spending money, from my standpoint, that they would have better saved in some sort of saving account. It's kind of like buying a series of brand new cars every month and deciding, I really didn't like it, and so you trade it in on the next car. I don't like this one. I'm going to trade it in on this one. No, I don't like it. I'm going to trade it in on this one. And that's pretty much a summarization of what I saw internal in Kodak from about 1980 to about 1995. And in addition to which, they misestimated, now here's a case where it wasn't their fault, they misestimated the collapse of the analog market. Of course, you can say that they misestimated it because they misestimated the introduction dates of digital or when it was going to become important. Yeah, that's part of it, but everybody else was caught unaware by this too. Analog just collapsed. It decreased, and I've said this before, it decreased 35% in one quarter when Kodak's, Ilford's, and Agfa's models predicted 35% in a year. So that was going four times faster downward than anybody predicted. And that was in the year that Ilford suffered their financial setbacks and Agfa collapsed. So there you have it.
Do you honestly think that a film and entertainment group, or whatever you might call it, people that make product in Building 38, do you think that business is actually truly profitable? And that the rest of the Kodak non-making digital entities are just sucking the life out of Building 38? Or do you think that Building 38 has lost its profitability and who knows what can happen now?
Well, this time last year, Kodak did post a profit for the film and entertainment group. It's in their annual report. However, the losses overall by the company were such that no dividends were declared. And they haven't been since 2008. And of course, this year, since Kodak went Chapter 11, and they also aren't on the big board, they don't really have an annual report to declare, I'm given to understand. However, earlier reports said that even with the decline, there was profit in the film and entertainment group.
You really must think that with the demise of analog projection and motion picture houses, that's really got to be what probably 90% of what Kodak makes money on is Kodak Eastman color print film?
Yes. Eastman color print film is the biggest seller that Kodak has. It and the camera original film, ECN, represented 60% or more of Kodak's analog sales. C41 products and black and white products split equally, represented almost all of the remainder, with a very tiny fraction being E6 products. So E6 is probably almost, what should I say, 1%, 5%. C41 and black and white are 20 to 40% total. ECN and ECP. I said around 60%. It could have been as high as 80 at one time.
Do you think if you removed the motion picture equation from the product line with Eastman Kodak that single-use cameras, professional film, consumer film, black and white, E6, whatever it might be, is that enough product to continually operate in Building 38, making analog-coded products?
Okay, let's go back and say first, Ilford is making a profit selling just black and white materials, film and paper. If they can do it, Kodak can do it. That's one edge of the sword. Now here's the other edge. Kodak's machines are such high capacity that they can coat their entire world's production. I'm going to make this up, okay? This isn't real. But they can coat the entire world production of every product in 1 week. Now let's say that assumption is true. If it is, then the plant sits idle for the rest of the year. So no matter how you cut the mustard with that kind of scenario, you can't make a profit because you can't bring your employees in for 1 week out of the year. Now, Kodak is caught in a position kind of like that. Their production facility is so efficient that they can make everything very, very quickly, very cheaply. And what do they do with the excess capacity? They have to shut down. So here is a company that was running 24/7, 365. That's three shifts every day out of every year. Then they cut it back to two shifts 5 days a week. Then they cut it to one shift 5 days a week. And so the plant now is actually running below that. I don't know how many days they're fully running, but what they've done is stagger things enough that it works out, but the plant is approaching the ability to keep the building warm, keep the machines running, and keep the lights on. You see what I'm saying? They're too efficient for their own good.
So let me throw this wrench in it. Our fine buddies over in England at Ilford that make beautiful black and white product, and I'm not putting this in any kind of negative area, but it's a lot easier to coat black and white emulsion than it is to coat a chromogenic emulsion, especially with Kodak basically coating up to 38 to 40 layers in one pass. Yes, you can make black and white emulsion on equipment that was really designed in the 1940s or earlier. So with Kodak, when you look at that kind of equipment, if it sits idle, I mean, the stuff's going to start breaking. Things are going to start leaking. It's amazing if they can mix this chemistry and then they pump it through miles of stainless tubing to get to a coating machine and it goes through all this other stuff. If you don't use it, well, it's sort of like if you don't use it, you lose it, right?
That's right. And people don't realize that they are planning at Kodak today what they're going to be coating a year from now. Because they have to order the silver, they have to get all the chemicals synthesized, they have to make the emulsion, they have to test the emulsion, they have to test all the individual chemicals, they have to make the dispersions, test the dispersions, they have to do everything in line, and they've got all these crews on different floors moving. Everything is moving forward like choreography, and it's all got to come on stage at a given time. And if it doesn't, you miss it. If you miss your coating date, you're in trouble. This even happened at research scale. When I had a coating time and date, by God, I'd better be walking through the door, and Paul is standing right there saying, "Okay, Ron, I got the other end of your cart. See you later." That's the way it went. They were ready for you. So they're bringing everything together. If the machine even shuts down for a minute, things can clog the lines. You know what happens with gelatin sets.
Oh, when we were there, I've seen the lines, and I've heard the stories about things clogging and what happens.
Yeah.
It's really bad.
So here you go, the emulsions and the dispersions, the hardeners, the dopants, the doctors, and everything. They're all in these great big kettles with jackets on, held at coating temperature, which is normally about 100 to 105 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 to 45 degrees centigrade. They're held these great big jacketed kettles in the dark, and the pumps start, and all these things have to reach that hopper in the right sequence. You go with the bottom hopper, you start it flowing. You go with the next one up, it's flowing. The next one, it's flowing. And so if you have even a black and white material with three layers, you've got three slides running at the same time. And you may have 25 to 50 feet of line to fill to get to there. And it's all got to come together, and that's done in the light to get the coating bead working, and then they ramp up to speed and go dark. And then that's marked on the edge with a little marker, and they coat. The machine's at speed, and they just coat until the tanks are dry. Then they put another little marker on the side. They're watching it in infrared. They can see, oh, we're dry, tick. And he marks off the length coater and the distance coater. Now, the issue a lot of people miss, that coating machine had to be threaded with a mile of film to start with. I mean, you can't run film through unless you already have film there. You have to have leaders.
Right, so it takes at least 5,000 feet of leader.
Right. So now you've coated 5,000 feet of film. It's cut off and put onto a separate roll, and the original leader is brought around to the front end of the machine. And either it or a fresh set of leader re-thread the machine at the end of your coating. So you always got to have the machine threaded. You don't run it empty. And so you use, essentially, 3 miles of film to get 1 mile coated. You follow?
Yeah. Let me throw this one at you. The base material that film is coated on, this clear plastic, and I'm assuming that even with C41 masks film, the base fog, the orange-red that's on it, is applied by Kodak or whoever makes it when they make it. It doesn't come in colored. All the material comes in clear, right? Big, monster, huge, container-sized rolls of clear plastic.
Yes.
Now, you can't walk down the tap plastic and say, well, I need 15,000 feet of film base. This stuff's not stocked over the counter, and I'm assuming that Kodak doesn't make this product, correct?
Kodak makes it. You'll see an example of that in Bob Shanebrook's book.
So, with Kodak making their own film base, whatever machine makes that stuff must eat a lot of something. I'm assuming Ilford does not make their own film base.
That's right.
So they have to buy it, and I'm assuming that Ilfke and other Eastern European manufacturers does not make their own film base. So I'm assuming Fuji probably makes their own stuff in Japan. That's a whole different thing, and that's a different discussion. My point is if Kodak starts dropping on volume, because, see, they've been making billions of feet of this stuff because, well, every motion picture that's ever been seen is on a film, and it's got to be going through a projector, and now that this is not happening, where do you hit the point of no return if you're making your own film base? Does it go bad? Can they make it and sit in a warehouse for a decade? I mean, I don't know how this stuff works, but it's part of the equation, I think.
Well, I could use an analogy. Kodak made its own paper. When the volume of paper fell low enough, they could no longer sustain their paper-making plant. So they closed it down, and they started buying paper from Felix Schoeller in Germany. The paper that was sold to Kodak was made to Kodak's specification. There are several plants that make photo quality support. One of them is a British company who is presumably supplying their support to Ilford. So I would assume that if Kodak's filmmaking plant or support making plant fell low enough in throughput, they could either make a big batch of it and store it because it stores well, or they could go to the British company and buy it from them. I have used some of the film from the British company, and for my purposes, I find that it's not really that much different than Kodak material. So presumably there is an out for Kodak in that regard.
So do you think that we need to be concerned, or do you think everything's going to come out peachy and we're all good and we're going to be able to buy color chromogenic something from Kodak or with the Kodak name on it in the future, or is it time to start hoarding?
I don't think anybody needs to hoard. I think you'll see the Kodak label, but you'll see a different mix of products. They're certainly going to have to redistribute their product mix to optimize profitability. Last week, Kodak could not pay their, I think it was a $2 million utility bill, and the article didn't say which utilities, it just said couldn't pay the bill. And the court stepped in and somehow released the money or managed to at least prevent Kodak Park Utilities from being shut off. So Kodak is still in operation, and the court has made it clear that they will do everything possible to keep Kodak in operation for as long as possible. And the newspapers and television here say that looks like it's going to be a year from now, February 1st, 2013. That's about best I can say.
What's your thoughts on retiree benefits? and you're being one of the retirees, and I think you rely on your retirement for health care. So is this looking bright and happy, or what's up with that? Because I know you guys had some information lately, and they've had some meetings in town.
I have a letter sitting right next to me from Kodak and one from Kodak's attorneys. And what they basically say in them are, yeah, well, maybe, or possibly, or if. It's so legalese, you can't separate out what they're really trying to tell you. But the bottom line seems to be, we're not sure here at Kodak. We're not sure here at the attorneys. Let's just wait and see what develops. That was a pun. There are so many retirement plans. It looks like the unfunded plan terminated February the 1st. So they will not get funds from it, those that are getting funds from the unfunded plan. I don't know what portion of my retirement comes from the unfunded plan. It's not easy to determine. But if all of it came from the non-funded plan, I don't get a check for February. But since that doesn't represent all of it, I do have the investment plans that they allowed. That will continue to pay me. So that's the way it goes. We don't know. The medical plan, now, people recommended that you pay medical plans in advance to Kodak. Another attorney came to us online and said, don't do it, because if you pay Kodak, you become an unsecured debtor at the end of the bankruptcy proceeding. Because the money is going to Kodak, it doesn't go to your health care plan necessarily. So don't pay anything in advance. Let Kodak pay the benefit out of what they promised they'd have. So we've gotten several different opinions on the healthcare plan, including one that says, just wait, don't jump. And I'm taking that position on the whole thing. I'm going to wait and not jump. So there you are, Scott.
Well, I think that sort of sums it up in a nutshell. If you look at the document that we've discussed before, that was this PowerPoint presentation. The sad thing is the current management of Kodak wants to sell the Film and Entertainment Group. I mean, it's on the bottom half of the page that basically says bye-bye.
Yes, there are rumors about what's going on here about that. And the rumors are so diametrically opposed that I hate to discuss any of them.
Right, but I think if you read the document, it just says this is what we want to do for business and this is what we don't want to do. I just find it seems that Kodak Park is just up for the highest bidder.
Yeah. At the same time, though, did you notice that the reorganization in that presentation tucked some of the film division workings in with the digital?
Right.
It says we want to sell these, but we've made it harder to sell.
It's just so odd. And all we can really do is hope for the best. I mean, everybody wants to continue to have yummy, high-quality Kodak products be available.
Yeah, somebody commented on that recently on APUG, the high price of film, and another person commented on the high quality of Kodak. Good old Kodak quality. There you are. People have been buying cut-rate quality films, and a lot of complaints are starting to pop up about film curl, pepper spots on film, emulsion floating off. That's all in film. The emulsion floating off is film and paper. And then in the case of paper, the edges breaking away on fiber-based paper or the plastic RC support delaminating. So you see a lot of complaints popping up all over the internet about cut-rate materials. I would say I would buy Kodak or Ilford just for the quality issue. Okay?
Sure.
Fuji is harder for me to get, and the color negative materials are not as good, in my opinion, as Kodak's. Now, if I were going to buy a color reversal, I'd buy Fuji, but I don't do much reversal anymore. So there are my choices.
Can't beat a good piece of chrome.
Well, yeah, and Fuji doesn't make a bad product. It's just that their best range is outside of what I usually use. That's all. Well, I can get Ilford easily at the local stores as well as Kodak products.
Do you have to drive all around town to find Kodak film, or actually someone stocks it in town?
Actually, at this point in time, the closest photo store has shut down. I would have to drive down to RIT, park in the visitor's parking lot, and walk to the on-campus store, which is open to the public, and I could buy film there. That's the closest place. I can buy amateur Kodacolor gold at the local supermarket. That's about it. The local supermarket had film processing up until last year. They took it out. It was all Kodak equipment, and now I would have to drive about 10 miles to a Sam's Club to get it processed. There we are.
Wow, the largest manufacturer of color and black and white products worldwide, and you can't even buy it in town. Sort of says something for it, huh?
Yeah. Heim Graphic went out of business about, 3 months ago or 4 months ago. They were about 5 or 6 miles from here. And I'd go in and speak to Bruce, the owner, and his people. They were wonderful people. And I would buy film there and everything. But each time, it was less and less analog, more and more digital. And, of course, it's harder to make a profit on digital. So there you are. And, of course, the big processor in town went out of business this month. They closed their doors. So there's nobody locally doing it.
So really, if you live in the town where they make a lot of this product, it's almost impossible to get it done. I mean, you can go to Prowse, right?
Yes, I can. I can go to Prowse. They're in downtown. Actually, I can go to the Kodak employee store. I still have a card that will get me in there. And I can go to the Kodak employee store and presumably get film processed there, too. I haven't gone there lately, and I can probably get any Kodak product there on special order. But I've not gone there for about 2 years. Last time I went there, it was mostly stuffed teddy bears with Kodak logos on them and T-shirts with I was at Kodak. It used to be film, paper. It is open to the public, but the public can't make special orders. You have to show your card.
Right, but you would think that you would go into a company store and they would have everything they make on the shelf.
They used to. The place was jammed with color paper, color film, black and white paper, black and white film, processing chemistry. You used to be able to go in and buy Dectol and D76 and everything right across the counter. Then it dropped down and you had to special order. Then it dropped down and, well, we don't stock those and we don't special order them. Just went down and down and down. Now you can get teddy bears, though.
Well, that's warm and fuzzy, right?
Yeah. So, anyhow, there you have in a thumbnail what I saw happening at Kodak, a company that was kind of insular, made a lot of mistakes, spent money like it was going out of style or something, made a lot of acquisitions and made a lot of bad decisions, and now here we are. And somebody quoted George Fisher when he retired. He said, I'd have to have spent 10 times longer here at Kodak to fix up all of the problems. I'm making a quote that I'm not sure of, but I read that somewhere. And if that's true, that's indicative of what I've been saying. He saw the same thing. Lots of problems.
Well, let's hope that everything comes out good and somehow they can pull it out and we all have high-quality product to look forward to in the future. That's all we can hope for, right?
Yes, let's hope. But maybe let's talk again in a year about this.
Well, I think it's going to be an ongoing topic just because if you are a professional photographer or an advanced amateur and you really like the product, it's a concern, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
It's like having a loved one that's been diagnosed with cancer. Well, the success rate is pretty good these days. Let's all hope. And no matter what the doctor tells you, you still have that uncertainty, right?
Yeah, and then also you're facing this very painful surgery to remove the cancer.
Well, here's the thing. We love film. All the people at Fuji love film. Everybody loves film, right? But now this process is left in the hands of the bean counters. And the bean counters will look at it without any affection at all. And most likely they'll probably look at it with a prejudice, thinking, why in the hell do they even make this anymore? And they'll be the first ones to put the checkbox next to the death column and sell it off to whoever will buy it, right?
Yep.
That's the problem. No matter how much anybody at Kodak loves film, or anybody that's listening to this loves film, it's all now left up to a bean counter that might not really understand photography, and they're into digital, and they're going to look at film as like, what is this stuff, dude? That's what my grandmother used. And they'll take Kodak Park and sell it off for $20 million. Take it, get it out of here.
That's right.
One of the most important things in analog photography history is that you've completed your book. And we're going to go into this in detail in another program, but let's talk about it right now. Tell us what you can about your book. You've been working on this for a while. It's been printed on high quality Kodak Next Press digital printing, and it's ready to buy.
Yeah, I pick up the first one on Monday from the printer. I have the prototype sitting in front of me. It's about 230-some pages long. It's got about 130-some illustrations, it looks like. It's been reviewed by a whole bunch of my peers, and as I said in the book, you can complain all you want about the writing quality of the book. But after a review by five emulsion-type people, I've got to say that I'm pretty darn sure it's accurate. So when it gets out there, it has 14 formulas in it, and two of those came from Jim Browning and Mark Osterman with their permission. So people have seen those elsewhere, but all of the others are new and unique. I know some people say, but this looks like an emulsion already published. Well, form follows function, Scott, and almost every emulsion is going to be similar to some degree. I can say truthfully that only one emulsion in the book came from another book, and it is highly modified to move it forward into the modern era. So that's the book, essentially, with lots of illustrations, lots of examples, lots of curves, and lots of pictures. I'm not sure of the pricing yet, but it should be on sale within 2 weeks.
And now we have the book and the DVD, so everybody that was waiting can now step up to the pay window and purchase himself a book and a DVD for unlimited enjoyment and education.
That's right. The DVDs will be sold separately. The book will be sold separately. And the book and DVDs will be available in a combination pack with a discount. The discount can't be very big because I'm shaving it so close. I'm just breaking even, barely. Also, I will be making donations to APUG and to George Eastman House. So part of the income is going to two very worthy organizations.
It's a great time for photography, and no better time than now to learn how to make your own emulsions.
Speaking of that, we'll be having a series of workshops at George Eastman House on those.
Right, so you can always sign up for that, and great time to learn and be involved. Buy the book, get the DVD, go to a class, and if you're not into making your own stuff, go buy more film, because that's what keeps these companies alive. And if you want to shoot film, you have to buy film.
Yes.
That's it. Ron, we look forward to the next chat here. We're going to be talking about the book more, and there's a lot of great things going on with yourself, the workshops at George Eastman House, and we really appreciate your time today chatting about your thoughts on Kodak, and we all hope for the best, buddy. So thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome, Scott. Talk to you again soon. Take care.
Well, there you go. The ever-fabulous Ron Mowry. Who knew? Xerox, verbatim, a lot of things that went wrong with Kodak. Inkjets, who knows? Who knows what could have happened differently? But that's the way the ball rolls, and this is what's going on today, and we really appreciate Ron joining us today, and we're all thankful that we have photographic products to shoot, from Fuji to Kodak to Ilford to all our Eastern European friends and everything in between. We all love film, and we don't want it to go anywhere. So, of course, again, thanks to Ron Mowry for that insightful look at what Kodak did wrong. The Inside Analog Photo radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm for their full line of instant cameras and film, and, of course, fine quality Fuji Crystal Archive paper over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. Our friends over at DR5 for black and white chrome at dr5.com. And, of course, our media partners of the Analog Photography User Group at apug.org. And our official philanthropic partner, George Eastman House, over at eastmanhouse.org. I've been your host, Scott Shippard, here on Inside Analog Photo. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.